Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring Team Poker Stars pro Dennis Phillips with Paul Harrah's. Brought to you by Poker Stars and the Poker Players Alliance. Shut up and put your money
where your mouth is. Winner, winner, chicken dinner. You got
to know. Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS.
Thank you, sir. May I have another?
Coming up on the show today, a man who many consider to be poker's newest superstar, Daniel Cates, a.k.a. Jungleman 12, the guy who's taking on the Durr Challenge. He'll join us later on this hour. Hello, I'm Paul Harrah's, sitting aside Team Poker Stars pro Dennis Phillips here at Table 2 at Harrah's St. Louis.
Absolutely, and I got my normal night's sleep last night. I left Las Vegas at 11:55 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
Arrived in St. Louis at 7:40 and haven't stopped since.
Well, you and I have something in common there in that we both were in Vegas recently. I got back from there Sunday night, took a late flight home myself, went out there to play in some of the cash games. I know you didn't get to play much poker while you were out there, but I was actually very upset about something while I was out there.
Whoa.
You know, lately I've been trying to play a lot of a PLO, pot limit Omaha, because once you've played a bunch of PLO, no limit hold'em can be boring at times compared to the excitement of PLO.
The swing factor in PLO is right there.
There's a lot of variance in PLO.
A lot of variance.
Absolutely. So we have great PLO games here in St. Louis.
Absolutely.
In fact, you can go to most decent-sized poker rooms in the Midwest, and maybe they don't have PLO every day, but certainly on the weekends, you're going to be able to find a pot limit Omaha game, even small ones, like a 1-2-5 game, 2-5, something like that.
And I can name a ton of the pros that love playing the PLO and play it in preference over the no limit right now.
Would you believe me if I told you that in Las Vegas, it was almost impossible to find a PLO game going on? Now, I know this is kind of between tournament action time. The Festa al Lago is just about to get going at Bellagio, and we're in kind of a little bit of a downtime here in between other major events going on there. But I played at the Venetian, where sometimes they do get a 1-2-5 game going late in the day, and certainly on Fridays and Saturdays.
Okay.
Couldn't get it going there. Put my name on the list. I was the first name on the list. Played there all day long in the No Limit Hold'em games, and by the time I left, there were three of us on the list at Venetian.
Well, I tell you, if you're the first one on the list and the only one on the list, you won't lose a lot.
Well, that's true. But it's not like it's not like my name showing up on the list is intimidating people to stay away. It's that there aren't players. I went to Aria the next night, and there's a guy there who has been trying to get games going there, and he says he gets it going maybe four nights a week. I played in that game. It lasted 1 hour before it broke up, and we never got more than six-handed.
Yeah.
The next day, I went to Bellagio. No PLO going on. I again started the game. Finally, we had four of us on the list. We all sat down at the table, and I insisted that they start the game with the four of us because, you know, once a game gets going,
of course.
Then if somebody calls in, hey, is there PLO today? Yeah, we just started a game. They'll come over, and they'll fill up the seats. Or somebody else in the room who doesn't want to play with only two or three people, once you get four people, then five people, then six people, now you got a game and it's going to fill up. That game lasted all of 5 hours. Never got full, never got to nine seats. We only had eight people in it. I will grant you that one of the reasons it broke up after 5 hours is because we were down to four-handed and three of us, myself included, had all the money on the table. One guy only had a few hundred left. We busted quite a few players. But it's impossible for me to believe that in Las Vegas, Nevada, one of the hotbeds of poker.
Absolutely.
You can't find enough people to get a decent PLO game going on. And I'm talking about low limits. We're playing 2-5.
See, I find that hard to believe a little, too, because I've been in the Bellagio. I was out at the Red Rock. Captain Tom, a couple other guys were there. And we started a mixed game where we're playing, you know, just a variety of, of whatever.
Yeah.
And we got it going and got locals to join in. And we had a full table before long.
I even suggested that. Let's get a half No Limit Hold'em, half Pot Limit Omaha game going on.
Okay.
Nope. Not people don't want to come over and play that. I'm really, really disappointed.
Yeah, I am. I'm a little shocked at that. Like I said, you can get a stud game going. You can get all sorts of odds and ends going.
One of the dealers at Bellagio who was at our table, who heard me talking about this with one of the other players,
right.
She said, I'll be honest with you. We get PLO, of course, going every day during the 8 weeks of the World Series of Poker.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, there's poker everywhere and every kind.
Yeah.
except for that, she said, this was the first game of PLO she's dealt at the Bellagio in 2 years. And she's a full-time dealer there. That, I don't know what's wrong with the game not infiltrating PLO Las Vegas enough. But we've got to get more PLO going there. Like I said, you play in the Midwest or in the South or in Texas.
Yeah.
One of the guys who was in the game plays in a big PLO game in Houston. I said, is it all PLO? He says, that's all we play, buddy.
Wow. Okay.
That's all they play.
But I'm trying to come up with some reason. I mean, I know a lot of people go out to Vegas and they want to play. A lot of the grinders that are out there want
yes.
to play the No Limit because they get all the tourists that come in.
Right.
You know, the weekend warriors that are going there and do their wonder and lose their whatever their bankroll is and
yep.
go home and talk about it.
Right.
But, you know, just because of that, there's no reason they can't do it on a PLO game.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
Yeah.
That's odd. That's
very, very odd.
Okay.
One other thing we got to talk about at the Bellagio. A guy who you know because he was one of your fellow original November Niners from the main event in 2008.
Okay, it's not Peter Eastcake. Keep going.
Got robbed at
Whoa.
Bellagio on Monday. Scott Montgomery was robbed in one of the men's rooms at Bellagio. He put this out on Twitter about 9 o'clock Las Vegas time yesterday morning. He said, got mugged today at Bellagio. Guy pulled a knife on me in the restroom. I gave him the $2,000 in my wallet, and he left. I called security, but they took like 15 minutes, so they didn't catch him. They're useless twits. Didn't even ask me to look at camera footage. And he also commented later on Twitter. He said, security pretty much just said, oh, well, life sucks. Have a nice day. I'm pretty annoyed. And then he posted on 2+2, and one person there said, getting robbed during a tournament break seems odd. He wasn't marked before he went in. Why would somebody randomly rob a full-grown man in a casino when there are so many other easier marks?
Huh?
Now, this is the second time in a few years that we've heard about a well-known poker player getting robbed at the Bellagio. Remember, Greg Raymer had that problem
exactly,
a few years ago, a year or two after he won the main event. He got accosted walking down the hall to his room. And Greg, I guess this befits a world champion, managed to get out of the situation without giving him a penny, basically beat the guys up and got into his room safely.
Yeah. As Greg said, he leaned against him and they gave. So, yeah, that's...
That is a quote from him, not us.
That is true.
Yeah.
But actually, I know of a third person who backpack was stolen.
Mm-hmm.
And it had, I don't know, some $5,000 or something. And I mean, it's a substantial amount.
Yeah.
But at least there, they went back and they got the tapes and they saw a picture of the guy doing it and saw him walk out of it. Couldn't identify him, still didn't know he never got any money back, but at least they did go through the tapes and everything.
Now, do you think that the Bellagio has any kind of responsibility to reimburse somebody once you've been robbed in their men's room? Or ladies' room, for that matter? You know, there are no cameras in there.
Yeah, I know, and I don't know that legally they would be responsible for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm telling you, word like this gets out, and people start worrying about going to the Bellagio because 2000. I'm sorry you lost your 2000.
Yeah.
But there are times you and me and everybody else out there has a hell of a lot more than 2000 in their pockets.
Right.
So you know, Greg had a hell of a lot more than
yes,
2000
did.
In his pockets.
Yep.
So this could get very, very serious.
Mm-hmm.
If there's an issue there, and I don't know whether there is or not, but that's now three cases that we can name.
Yep.
They need to look into this seriously.
Yep, absolutely.
And yes, I think they need to consider doing something to compensate Scott in some way, especially if they reacted that way to him.
Well, I think that if what they told him is really what he says they told him.
Well, yeah,
you know,
that's true.
We're going based on his account and what he posted, probably angry.
He probably was a little extreme.
So who knows what that is, but I don't think that they have a legal obligation to do it.
I don't think so. That I'll agree.
And I don't want them to start putting cameras in the men's room.
Well, no. That wouldn't work too well either.
But you know what? I think that there's a responsibility for a player to never flash your cash. Be very careful about that. And particularly people who have a lot of money who are playing in big games, they tend to be a little bit reckless with that.
Yeah.
You and I have both seen that in many places.
Oh, yes.
They go in the men's room to count their cash. You don't know who's around you. You don't know who's looking.
Yeah.
Also, I wonder if they paid off Scott, does that now open the door to other people making claims, you know, coming out of the men's room, hey, I just got robbed.
Yeah.
Then they can't find the guy. They don't know what happened. Nobody knows what happened in the men's room. Somebody said, I had $5,000, and some guy just, gave a description, and, you know, they never find them.
Right.
Bellagio's not going to pay off everybody.
No, absolutely not. But they could find a way to satisfy Scott without making it, you know, without a big uproar or anything like that. I think that if there is this case, then they need to do something about it. I'm not sure how you would counter that. Again, restroom, not exactly a place you want cameras or anything.
Here's what the Bellagio should do. You know what? We're sorry this incident happened, and we can't compensate him for his loss, but we are certainly going to review our security here and do everything we can to make sure that this never happens to another Bellagio customer.
Yeah.
I mean, that should have been the first thing anybody said from Bellagio.
Yeah.
To reassure people that, you know, when you go play, and this is one of the most prestigious poker rooms and casinos in Las Vegas.
Yeah, because if you go out there right now, I guarantee there'll be, I don't want to name any names, but there'll be several people sitting there with huge piles of chips. They have their own little box there, granted, a lot of them, where they have the credit, so they aren't carrying all this cash around. Don't get me wrong that way.
Yep.
But I guarantee there's people walking in and out of there with large amounts of cash.
Yep.
It's a perfect place for somebody to take advantage of if the security is lax.
Right.
And you don't want to have that reputation. That'd be, oh, man, that'd be nasty.
Craig Marquis, who was another original November Niner with you and Scotty,
yes,
says, sucks, dude, but it's only 2K. You didn't get shivved.
Okay. All
right. Just write it off as a bad beat.
Okay.
And you know what? In the long run, it's not the 2K.
No, it is. Absolutely, it's not.
It's the frustration of having that happen.
Correct.
And again, you know, we're not talking about in a dump. You know, this is the sort of thing that used to happen to Doyle and Slim and Sailor Roberts and those guys when they were trying to make a living as poker players on the road in Texas 50 years ago. This is what they had to worry about. Some guy pulling a gun or a knife on them. They, of course, were probably carrying themselves, but it shouldn't happen in 2010 in a secure place like a big-time casino.
No. Not a place like the Bellagio, because everybody, I mean, that's the biggest games in town are played there most of the time. That's just not right.
All right, let's see what else is on our news desk here. Last week on ESPN's coverage of the main event, and they were up to day 6. Tonight will be coverage of day 7 on ESPN. Filippo Candio, who we know makes it to the main event, an Italian player. Kind of a, I don't want to call him a hothead, but he's an excitable guy. He got into a hand with pocket aces against pocket queens, and when his aces held up, he got up and started screaming hysterically, you know, really, really celebrating very, very loudly. And a World Series of Poker floor guy went over and assessed a one-round penalty on him. And he said, I didn't know this rule. I didn't know anything about this. And they said, well, you know, we do have an excessive celebration rule. Kind of like the NFL, I guess.
It is. Do you remember where that came from, that Havad Khan, when he went nuts there in front of the cameras and the yelling and the screaming and being very, very vocal and very physical about it. So they, I don't agree with the ruling, but it
is. You don't? Why not?
Well, because you're wanting the excitement. You're wanting good TV. You're wanting people to enjoy the game. What you don't want is them to berate other players. You don't want them to do something that way, maybe. But to be honestly excited about it and stand up because you just made a major, won a major hand or something like that, I honestly think they should be able to. Now, if they do it on every hand, obviously there's a problem. If they do berating other players, obviously there's a problem.
Yep.
But for somebody to get a miracle card on the river and stand up and yell and shout and go over and high-five his friends and everything like that, no, I don't see anything wrong
with that. I agree with you about the whole berating thing. It's like, you know, they had the F-bomb rule. You were not first you weren't allowed to say it at all, and then people said, you know, poker players are going to take bad beats, and they're going to say that word, and you can't penalize them for that. You should only penalize them when somebody uses it directed at another player or a staff member or a dealer or whoever. And to me, I agree with you. You know, if you're taunting another player, you're being loud
totally
and obnoxious
different.
And getting in their face, even from across the table, then I could see assessing the penalty.
Yeah.
But we talked about a month ago in watching the ESPN coverage about this guy, Ted Bort, who got into the famous hand with Prahlad Friedman with the clock and all that sort of stuff. This is the guy who was barking all the time. they finally told him, hey, knock it off or we're going to give you a penalty. They may have even penalized him a one-hand penalty. I don't remember. But here's the question. You're up to day 6 of the main event.
Yeah.
You've looked forward to this. Even if you're just a young poker pro and you're finally getting out there and playing for the first time, here's a guy who traveled from Italy to go to Las Vegas, looking forward to playing in this. He's made it to day 6. You can understand the adrenaline is rushing through his veins.
Absolutely.
Can you really take it out on a guy when he celebrates like that?
Again, that's hard. Now, it wasn't in this case, and obviously he did keep going on in the tournament. But what happens if he was one of the short stacks? What's happened if the blinds were coming in, and it really was going to affect his play to have to sit out through a round?
Yeah.
I mean,
he just doubled up, and now he's got 9 or 10 big blinds. And one round can take away, you know,
more than
one of those blinds with antes.
Oh, absolutely. You know, all of a sudden, he could be down back right back down to, you know, 6, 7 blinds just by the time he's able to sit down and play again.
Yeah.
You don't want to do – I don't care what sport it is. You don't want to take away or have a referee or an ump affect the outcome of the game.
I agree.
They take it to extremes when you watch pro basketball and the fouls in the last 30 seconds that are non-existent. I mean, there are some things extremes. But, yeah, day 6 of the main event and you get penalized just because you got happy.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if they had warned him before.
That's true.
I mean, if they took him aside earlier in the tournament and said, hey, you know what, you're being a little too boisterous here.
Right.
Calm down a little bit. We don't mind people going, woohoo, but, you know, walking around and screaming and like that.
That's a good point.
A little bit too much. But you know what? If they hadn't given him a warning before, that's even more reason to not give him the one-round penalty. Take him aside and tell him that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You got to, again, in the spirit of the game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't like, they call it the Hawat Khan rule. Mm-hmm. I just don't like it.
I agree. We also don't like the Jamie Gold rule.
I was going to mention that myself right there. You took the words out of my mouth because I do not agree with that. That's part of poker.
Yeah, I agree. Congratulations to a St. Louisan by the name of Scotty Clark. Scotty has been a grinder here in St. Louis for quite a while. He writes about poker for the Inside STL website and well-known to everybody who plays poker here in St. Louis. Scotty went to the Horseshoe Southern Indiana, where they've got a World Series of Poker circuit event going on now, and he final tabled a couple of events and took down event number 5, a $350 horse tournament.
Sweet.
I believe that's Scotty's first ever circuit ring. And congratulations to him. It's good to see a local guy taking down something like that. Michael Mizrachi, speaking of guys in this year's main event, got into a little bit of legal trouble with a website called Deliverance Poker. I'd never heard of Deliverance Poker. Have you?
Okay, me neither.
At the beginning of the main event, you may have noticed that Michael was wearing Deliverance Poker's logo. I don't know if it was on his hat or on his shirt or whatever it was, but if you watched last week, all of a sudden Michael had a Full Tilt Poker logo on. The Deliverance Poker people were not happy with this. They say that they made a deal with him, and he got $150K from them and a tiny little percentage interest in the company and advance expenses related to poker tournaments. They say they signed a deal with him in July of 2009. And now here it was, the main event, and of course, he's having a player of the year kind of year.
Absolutely.
Taking down the 50K Players Championship at the beginning of the World Series of Poker and now making it to the November 9 this year and switching allegiances in the middle of the main event. What do you think of that?
Well, unfortunately, it's not the first time I've heard of that happening. I don't know the story here. I know Michael's a friend of mine. But if you have an agreement in place, if they have signed documentation for it, I think he could be in a lot of trouble.
Yep.
And it's him, totally. It's not, will not affect the other people he signed with. Should not, I don't think. Be it a poker star, as a Full Tilt, or whoever. But if you have an agreement in place, you know, you need to honor it.
Now, how does it work? Last year, Joe Catta had UB stuff on during the main event up until he made it to the November 9. Got to the November 9,
correct.
He was affiliated with Poker Stars.
Correct.
So, but that didn't happen until he'd actually made it to the November 9. Is that correct?
That is correct. And also, the agreement that he had with UB was not one for the November 9 or anything. It was only to wear their items for that day. So he had a limited contract with them.
Oh.
Now then, they wanted, obviously, to pursue it and everything.
Sure.
But obviously, if that's all he had, he was still a free agent. He could do whatever he wanted.
Yeah. In the grinder's case, if you're Full Tilt Poker, don't you make this thing go away as quickly as you can by just writing a check to Deliverance Poker? And would Deliverance Poker accept a nice check, you know?
Yeah. They may think even the publicity they get with this might be better than the check.
The lawsuit, you mean?
Oh, yeah.
If they end up getting anything out of it.
Well, that's true.
Because I'm not sure that this is going to, you know, this is not going to get coverage on ESPN. Remember that all that, well, you know this better than anybody, all that ESPN coverage gets rerun and rerun and rerun and rerun for years. And now they'll see Full Tilt on the grinder when he goes to November 9.
Absolutely. People don't realize there's a, I don't know what the count is now, 145 different sites now or something like that. It changes every day.
How do some of these sites even make money? I mean, you know, PokerStars biggest in the world, Full Tilt number two, UB's out there, Doyle's Room's out there. In Europe, Party Poker does very, very well. But some of these tiny little sites, I mean, if you're the 139th biggest poker site in the world, are you really, who's playing on these sites?
Well, again, I honestly don't know because I don't play on those sites or anything. My guess would be that they try to get starter ups. Maybe they're local regional ones. Maybe they're just a skin. And there's several of them that are together, and they're actually using the platform and everything for a larger one.
That's very possible.
So I don't know for sure the answer to that, but yes, I would be. I think I would rather play on a well-established and larger site where you have a wider variety of games, where you know you can go on there and play what you want to play.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a break here, and then we'll be joined by Jungleman 12, who plays a lot of online poker. In fact, he's taking on Tom Dwan, Durr, in the Durr Challenge, and also Isildur won in some of the highest stakes online games. And by the way, he's crushing them. Daniel Cates will join us in a couple of minutes. But first, this portion of the show is brought to you by PokerStars.net, the website Dennis plays on.
Absolutely, and they have so many things going on there. I'm going to try and touch on a couple of them. Obviously, the Million Dollar Challenge is back. You can go on the PokerStars.net and qualify to play on that one. They've got the big game going. Mm-hmm. They've got everything in the world. The PCA, the PokerStars Caribbean Adventure, is going. They've got another one going on now that is limited just to the U.S. and Canadian players. They call it the North American Poker League, and they are running free rolls weekly in there that total $4,500, $500 a night, free roll. It costs you nothing. You go in there, you download the program, you play for free, you have a chance to win cash, you have a chance to improve your game, you have a chance to make new friends.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't see a downside to this anywhere on it.
None.
So they are doing this every single night of the week. A minimum of $500 into the free roll, put up by PokerStars, go on there, have some fun, learn the game, put your skills together. PokerStars, it's the biggest in the world. It's 24/7. It's award-winning programming. This is the place you need to go if you want to learn how to play poker.
PokerStars.net. Find the poker star in you. He's Team PokerStars Pro, Dennis Phillips. I'm Paul Harris. This is The Final Table. Our podcasts and our merchandise are all available on thechipleader.com. And our show is every Tuesday at 3 on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com. Welcome back to the Harris Poker Room, the place where you can play poker 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and get into any of the 14 tournaments that run here, whether you're a small stakes poker player, or just getting into the $40 and $60 tournaments, or you're coming in for the monthly $310, which goes, by the way, this Saturday, the third Saturday of every month at 2 o'clock. Harris is a great place to play in St. Louis. Also a great place to eat. They got more choices and more value. A restaurant located right on the casino floor called Grill 21 with a new $5 value menu. Things like the St. Louis Cordon Bleu, the delicious Italian Sloppy Joe, the loaded steak fries, the classic chili cheese, the breakfast buster. They've even got double, triple, and quadruple burgers now at the Grill 21. Get your hands nice and greasy and then start handling some chips and cards.
Just what a poker player needs. He's sitting at a table for 8 and 10, 12 hours at a time. Let's get some nice, greasy burgers there.
Absolutely.
Right.
You can also come in and do your football picks every day during the week, and there are winners up to $10,000 every Sunday. And, of course, this will be the home of the World Series of Poker Circuit event for the first 2 weeks of April 2011 once again. We're looking forward to all of that. For details, go to the website harrisstlewis.com. Harris St. Louis, one of the proud sponsors of The Final Table. Our guest today has taken the poker world by storm. Well, let me ask you, in your last six sessions, have you won more than $600,000? Very few people have because you're not playing nosebleed stakes like Dan Cates is. Online, he is known as Jungleman 12. Lately, he's been playing some big, big games against Tom Dwan in the Durr Challenge and also taking on Isildur 1. And so we're happy to welcome him and talk a little bit about nosebleed online action. Hi, Dan. Welcome to The Final Table.
Hi, what's up?
It's nice to have you on the show here. How are you doing with the Durr Challenge, by the way? We hear that you're plus 600K or more.
Yeah, I'm plus about 650K. Over 7,500 hands. Obviously, we haven't played that many hands, but still a pretty sizable lead.
And the Durr Challenge is that you're going to play 50,000 hands of 200, 400, no limit hold'em. And at the end, if you're $1 ahead, Durr owes you, in addition to anything you beat him out of, he has to pay you $1.5 million. If he comes out a dollar ahead, you've got to pay him $500,000. So you're getting a 3-to-1 prop bet going there in addition to that. You've got to feel pretty good about where you are now, or do you chalk up where you are now to just early variance?
Yeah, I'm feeling pretty good about it. Hopefully it'll just be indicative of what happens in the future.
Quick question, because very few people play at this level, obviously. You're talking 200, 400. What size pots do you usually get in on these heads up? I mean, average pot, do you have any idea what that would be?
Average would probably be like, well, if it's not like a full pre-flop, then average is probably going to be like 10,000 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Like any significant happens post-flop.
And how do you guys decide when you're going to play?
Well, we haven't really been planning. We've just been playing it by ear mostly. Durr's been pretty busy lately. So we'll probably get around to playing more like late October, I believe. But mostly we've just been looking for when our schedules align.
But, I mean, okay. do you text each other? Do you call each other? Do you just log on and see if the other guy's online? How does that work out?
Well, so far, the only thing that's really worked is just logging on and seeing if the other guy's online. Durr hasn't put that much initiative into playing, it seems, although he's been really busy lately, so understandable. For me, the only thing that's really, I mean, whenever I get started, it's usually I find him online, and then I talk to him on AIM, and then we decide to play, or not to play.
Well, Durr is also trying to get more involved in live tournaments and such that he wasn't doing as much before, and I imagine he played quite a bit over the WSOPE and such over there in Europe. So it may have a little more free time to do it. All right. Well, you need to keep us kind of updated on what's going on with that. But I want to get back. How do you move up that quickly? You have not been playing. No offense, but you're 20 years old. How do you get up to that level that quickly? How do you bankroll manage yourself to be able to afford to move up to these other levels? Haven't you had some setbacks?
Definitely had some setbacks, but I can't say that I have run bad, honestly. In addition, it hasn't been that quick because I started playing like over 3 years ago. I mean, one thing is also just aggressive bankroll management. Like, a lot of these guys aren't really comfortable without moving up with, like, 100 buy-ins. Normally, I was a little bit ambitious and moved up with, like, 40 buy-ins or something like that. Which is, I mean, it's not foolhardy exactly, but it's
Well, it's pretty risky, though, because all it takes is one or two bad beats. If you're only going with 40, I mean, you could lose half your bankroll very quickly.
Yeah, that's definitely the risk you take. It's unlikely, especially if you're, like, killing the limit before that.
Uh-huh.
But if you want to play the high stakes, like, pretty fast, then you have to take risks like that. And also, even if you lose half your bankroll, it's not the end of the world. You can just go back to the other stake you were playing and just keep grinding that and work your way up, which is what's happened a couple times for me. Although I haven't lost, like, half my bankroll. I've lost, well, for 100, 200, I actually lost half my bankroll, but for, like, I lost, like, a third or something, mm-hmm. third or fourth.
And when that happened, you dropped down to 10 and a quarter or 25.50?
Well, when I lost half my bankroll at 100, 200, I dropped down to 5,100. It's normally just the stake that you were playing at previously, and also just, like, tighter game selection and stuff like that. That all makes sense to another game selection when you're in a slump than when you're beating everyone. When you're beating everyone, it makes sense to play everyone mm-hmm. or play even more people than you're usually playing.
Well, it also obviously helps be one of the better players online, too, to do this.
You know what? In that regard, have you gotten better or have you just gotten ballsier?
I love that question.
I think, honestly, both go kind of hand in hand. Like, maybe one day or one month or something, I've become like more like a bit more ballsier, and then another month because of that, I've become better. I think it goes hand in hand with just playing and getting more experience. Both, it's funny because both sort of kind of both getting better and both having balls kind of require each other. The only way to really build those things is to. trying to build and just keep putting yourself out there.
Yeah, you don't get better by playing scared poker.
No, this is true.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Another question. A lot of guys, especially people in our generation, they grew up playing the live poker and all the different variances you have there from watching the people and watching the betting pattern and such. If you're shifting from live and trying to play online, have you got some words of wisdom for them, some way to begin, some guidance on it that you can help out? Just a general person that's just starting to play online but knows the game well.
Well, one thing I would say, although it's probably not that easy to do, is just start out playing lower stakes, because first of all, it's a different field, and then second of all, it's a tougher field online. The online games, if you look at them in terms of like the level of gameplay of each average opponent compared to the stakes of live, the level of gameplay is higher at the same stake, significantly higher at online stakes than it is in live stakes. So, as it turns out, it's just like harder to beat, basically, until you have the same sort of theory that behind your play that the online guys have. It takes a bit more practice to beat online, I would suspect, although I haven't played too much live yet to really tell.
Have you become an expert in picking up on strategic tells online? Obviously, I'm a live cash game player, and I rely considerably on live tells from the players that I'm sitting at the table with. This is a skill that Dennis developed also, which got into the November 9 a couple of years ago. Is there an online equivalent to that?
Not exactly. I mean, you could say that like betting tells are like the big thing online, although I wouldn't say that's the equivalent. You could say I've become pretty good at picking up betting tells pretty much online. One of the most important information is the betting information. I guess you could say that actually there is sort of an equivalent to that, which would be like timing tells, which like kind of applies some psychology to it. Although timing tells, in my experience, aren't like the most reliable thing. But there's some classic ones, like if a guy check snap calls, they generally aren't very strong or something like that. Or, I mean, they could have as strong as a top pair, but in general, it's not usually like a nut type hand, stuff like that. So there's sort of an equivalent, but not really. And what really matters is like just focusing on betting patterns, although that's universal to all poker.
But when you're talking about timing tells, you're talking about, let me give you an example. Your heads up against the guy, I mean, whether this is in a cash game or online, it may be the same, I don't know. And he check calls you with what you think is probably a draw, and then when the river card comes out, it's not a flush card, it's not a straight card, and he bets out real quickly, bets, you know, a big bet real quickly there. Quite often, that will be a bluff. Now, is that something that you can pick up online? Is that the sort of thing you're talking about when you say a timing tell?
Yeah, potentially. I don't know how, like, true that one is or not. Normally, people play a little, don't usually take a line like that at the stakes I play, but yeah, that could be an example of one.
Right.
If it out, like, really quickly, yeah.
All right, when you're playing this large stake, there are times when you're going to run, even for a short period of time, bad, and you're going to lose a pretty large sum. Psychologically, how do you handle losing a large sum? Because the hands come so quickly online. It's not like in a game here where we can take a trip to the John or something like that and go beat our head against the wall for a minute. You know?
You call your friends, you won't believe the bad beat. I'm walking this one off for 15 minutes. Can't walk it off in the Dirt Challenge, can you?
I mean, I guess you could, like, after you lose, you could go and say, oh, man, I just took, like, 20 bad beats in a row. My ace has just got cracked, like, 5 times in a row or something like that. But in all seriousness, a lot of it's just experience. Like, the more you play, the less you're inclined to, like, tilt based off, like, what happens, the more you're inclined to just be, well, not oblivious, but just keep your cool when things aren't going your way. In addition, it's also ideal to keep the results of poker independent of your, it's also ideal to keep the, how, keep your mindset in life when you're away from the tables, just independent of the results of poker, which is also relevant to bankroll management, because psychologically, if you lose half your buy-in, that's going to affect you pretty much no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, if you can do that, then you won't be as upset when you lose. although I can't say that I'm like the best in the world at that either. Everyone's, I mean, most people aren't that good at it. My friend Yuron Hedges is probably one of the best in the world. He's at that, as far as I can tell, he just never tilts no matter what. He could lose like half his bankroll and just right, get up.
All right.
And just not feel a thing.
But do you see, I'll ask you another question. I've asked a couple of other people. Do you see that poker and its play and maybe its discipline or its patient teaching or something, does that help you in aspects of your real life or vice versa, things in real life that help you with poker?
He has no real life. He's online all the time waiting for dirt to log on.
Not quite. But, you know,
I don't know about that.
I'm kidding.
He's kidding. He's kidding. He's laughing about it. But no, really, do you see things in poker that maybe help you in other aspects? Bankroll management, patience, you know, stopping and analyzing it, trying to read your opponents? I don't know.
Yeah, sure. There are lots of, I suspect there are a lot of ways in which poker or the general skills in poker can be applied to just like anything. One thing for me would be that, for poker, one thing that made me so successful in poker was just ability to just never give up and just, like, keep playing. Well, I don't want to put it that way because I think that's important, but at the same time, you have to, like, learn from your mistakes and stuff like that. But anyways, what was important for me, one lesson I learned from poker was just to, if you really want to get something in life, you just have to work really, really hard at it. Mm-hmm. You have to definitely have to exert a lot of effort to get it. And that's an example of one thing that can, one lesson that can be taken out of poker. Another would be the fact that you have to learn from your mistakes as well, because if you're still trying to get something and you're exerting a lot of effort but you're not learning from your mistakes, you won't get anywhere. And there's also like lots of other ways that are like a little bit less abstract, like in the stock market, obviously, poker applies. One of my friends tells me, like, it's almost exactly the same thing. So that's, like, with skill in poker probably, like, directly influences, like, skill and something else.
We're talking with Jungleman 12, Dan Cates, playing those nosebleed stakes online against Durr and Isildur 1. I'm Paul Harris, along with Team PokerStars Pro Dennis Phillips. We'll take a quick break and come back. We want to talk a little bit about a couple of the hands you played recently and more of the strategies you're using in these giant cash games as the final table continues with our podcast available on thechipleader.com and our show every Tuesday at 3 on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com. Welcome back to The Final Table, brought to you in part by the Poker Players Alliance, the group that fights for poker players like you and Dennis and me, and our guest Dan Cates as well. By the way, we talked last week about Washington State getting a judge there to rule against online poker.
Yeah, so ridiculous.
This is why you need to join the Poker Players Alliance to fight against that happening in other states. Go to theppa.org and find out what the Poker Players Alliance does and how cheaply you can join. Premium membership is $20. That's one Friday night at your buddy's house in that basement tournament he runs to help support poker for all of us. Keep it legal in every form, online, casinos, home games, and everywhere else. ThePPA.org, that's the website for the Poker Players Alliance. We're proud to be members. We're proud to have them as a sponsor of The Final Table. All right, so we're talking with Jungleman 12, who is Dan Cates, who's been playing these nosebleed stakes games, including the Durr Challenge. In the last six sessions, they've played about 7,600 hands out of the 50,000 they'll eventually get to. And he is up, here's the latest count, $657,774.50.
And 50, wait a minute, at 50 cents?
Well,
at this level, you're betting 50 cents. I love it.
Dan, is it weird to you that people are railing you online and keeping track of every hand and every penny?
Not really. I just, when I'm playing, don't really pay that much attention to it. I think it's kind of flattering, actually.
Yeah, so, I think it's very flattering.
So was it you or Durr that bet the 50 cents?
It's probably Durr before I raised them.
Let's talk about one of the hands that you played in your most recent session last week, where you had 7-6, and the flop came out 5-8-10, and you know, you've got the double gutter there, and you let out for 4,400. Now, I should point out that in every hand you guys are playing, as in most heads-up action, and you're playing exclusively heads-up here, it's always going to be raised pre-flop. Sometimes it's 3-bet pre-flop. In this case, you lead out for 4,400 on the flop, and Durr calls. And there's a 4 on the turn, giving you the straight, and you checked, and he checked behind. And then on the river, you actually did the online equivalent of going into the tank. You requested time when a king came out, and then you bet 12-4. And Durr called, and you take it down with a straight for about a 41K pot. I'm sure you remember this, and I'm curious if you could take us back through that hand a little bit about how the action goes, and particularly why you called time when the king comes on the river.
Well, first of all, I believe that with the way the action went, I must have 3-bet that hand. I must have re-raised out of the big blind. No, not flop. I just see that, which is pretty standard, especially with open-ended 8-outs to a straight, mm-hmm. although 9 wouldn't be that great. He could have queen-jack, and he called, and the turn was a 4. And I was just thinking that on that turn, he'd probably bet a 10, and if he bets a 10, I maximize value by checking anyways, and also there are lots of other things you can bet with as well that I might get more value out of by checking. Also, it makes maybe some sense to trap if he has like a weaker hand as well. Also, it's kind of not a standard line, so I thought it was a pretty good spot for the time. So, and then when he checks back, I sort of guess that his... did you have a question?
No, I was going to say, so when you bet the flop, when you see bet the flop with your double gutter and he calls... You put him on a 10. You're hoping he's got a 10, particularly when the 4 comes on the turn, and that's why you're checking the turn, hoping that he'll make that bet there, and so you can come over the top on him?
Well, he can have a lot of things. Just ideally he has, like, 2-pair or something that's drawing dead, like, I don't know, aces or something. But I just think that by checking, I play really well versus his range, no matter, like, what he has. I'm just thinking that checking happens to be better in this spot just because like there are a lot of hands that he might otherwise fold by bet. But if I check, he loses more money with those hands on later streets or loses like more money on that street in particular. Like if he has like queen-jack or king-queen or something, he might bet to get me off something like that.
Well, if he views...
He might...
No, go ahead.
He might bet to thinking I'm just check folding. It's also a spot that I'll be check folding a lot. But if I bet and he has king, queen jack or king queen, he's probably going to fold. So that's the reason why. It's kind of a summation of the reasons why I decided to check there.
Yeah, absolutely. It looks like a continuation bet on the flop. You may not have any part of that flop. For all he knows, he makes a bet there, can take it down. Yeah, no, I like the check there.
Okay, so then on the river, when the king comes out, which is irrelevant now because you made your straight on the turn, why'd you call time?
Well, I'm thinking, first of all, that his range in general is probably fairly weak in that spot. Like the possibility of hands isn't very strong. Like I think at this point he has like 8-9 or something like that. And I was also thinking, well, I mean, in retrospect, there probably wasn't much need to call time, just because thinking about it, betting is really what makes the most sense. I tend to think that in that spot, when I check, which is my other option, he's mostly just going to check back because his range is weak. In addition to that, I think that if I bet, maybe he thinks I'm trying to represent having the king. Maybe he thinks that I'm like trying to pretend I have ace king instead of have like jack two suited or just some random nonsense. In addition, It's unlikely, but he could raise me as a bluff or something like that. And from like the way the match had been going a lot in the past, I think he would think that I'm more likely to check straight there than bet. So for those reasons, I decided that.
I like the way you played it. I was just wanted to walk through the strategy for some of our listeners who, you know, may get into similar situations and wondering how to handle things, because for a lot of people, you know, if they're betting a continuation bet on that flop, when they make their hand on the turn, they're certainly going to be betting there again. But I like the way you're thinking about how, you know, what's he going to be calling me with here, and what could he have where he might put more money in the pot? Under what circumstances can I make that work? So, of course, we never get to see what Dura has here, because his hand gets mucked once we see you're straight. Mm-hmm. In retrospect, what do you think he had?
I don't remember what he had. He might have had, like, 10-7 or something like that, which is unfortunate, because against that hand, I should have bet the turn.
Yeah.
Hopefully, he just had like 8-9 and it happened to play it pretty well.
Actually, I think the 8-9 is a little more likely. I think on a 10 there, if you check on the turn, he's probably going to bet. I don't know. I would think so. If he had a 10 there, you bet. In fact, I would think he was probably weak enough, since he checked the turn also. You wanted to hand him the deck and say, pick a card, any card, because you're drawing dead. try and get some more money out there. Yeah. But, you know, in hindsight, there's always a way you can second guess about playing it. In my opinion, you probably did well on this one. Probably got about the maximum you could out of it, because I think he was fairly weak.
Yeah.
So I think he played it well. So, okay, cool.
Dan, who do you have who you go through hands with afterwards? Do you have somebody who's sweating you while you're playing these online? Do you have somebody who you're talking to afterwards? Hey, let's go over this hand that I played. What do you think of my play here? That sort of thing.
I don't really do that much. I usually kind of judge for myself whether I played it correctly or not. I talk a little bit with You're Not in Danger, especially more about PLO than Hold'em, because I'm not as sure in PLO.
Mm-hmm.
He's an example of a guy, and there's a couple other people for PLO as well. For Hold'em, yeah, I don't really do that. If someone's sweating me, it's usually me just, like, narrating, like, what I'm doing and stuff like that.
Who's tougher, Dur or Isildur?
No offense to Dur, but I think Isildur is the better of the two.
Really?
Okay.
What makes him better?
He's, in general, like, his style plays a little bit more up to date. It'd be kind of a vague response, but the one thing that makes him better is, he's a little bit trickier than Dur in some instances. In general, his ranges are a bit more balanced than Dur's, I guess you could say.
Well, you're also,
which also makes it more difficult.
Yeah. Huh? You're also not playing him for 43,000 more hands, and you don't really want to give him that compliment right now or anything.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to stir anything up here and have you give anything away, but you know that a lot of our listeners are listening, and you know they know Dur from watching him. Maybe not even online. Maybe they've seen him just on high-stakes poker or poker after dark or the big game or I don't think he's been on the big game, but other televised cash things or during the World Series, they know him that way. And so when you say that Isildur 1 is trickier than Dur, in their minds they're going, that's impossible. How can anybody be trickier than Dur?
Well, it's sort of like, it kind of depends on the spots. Dur's a tricky guy. It's kind of what he's famous for. I imagine he's like even trickier in 6-max, perhaps, than most. He's a little trickier in different spots that are a little bit more misleading. You have to play them and understand.
Okay. I can understand that. No problem. Got another question for you. The guy asked me, and I didn't really have an answer. Poker players sometimes, just like anybody else, can be a creature of habit. Do you have a routine you put together when you get ready to play? I mean, do you have, you know, snacks and a favorite chair you sit in and a this and a that, anything, or a time of day or certain days of the week? Is there any kind of habits that you get into that you like to do, to your comfort level, shall we say?
Actually, come to think of it, I'm sort of a creature of total lack of routine, much of what, in general. I just kind of tedious to me to have a routine. Let's see. Yeah, I don't really have any routines for playing online, although I do try to do things, like maybe if I have like a big match, I try to like meditate before playing it or just go over some notes or something like that. That much I do. Mm-hmm. Although if I like have a routine, it's mostly just because I think it's, I have to like kind of work for it. I have to put a lot of effort to actually maintain a routine. If my general nature is to not be orderly much at all.
So no superstitions, no eating all green M&Ms or anything like that, huh?
No.
You know, we're talking here about your online play because that's what you're famous for now. But I know you just got back from London and played in the WSOPE. I know in the 10K heads up, you played against Howard Lederer. And how many events did you play over there?
I think I played four. Yeah, I played four events.
How was that for you?
Well, I didn't cash, but it was still fun. And I mean, it was fun meeting everyone there, and it's a bit different from online, for sure. It was definitely a new experience.
How different was it for you, considering that you play heads-up cash games at nosebleed stakes, to play a 10,000 pound, not $10,000, yeah, but let's just call it a 10K heads-up tournament, as opposed to a cash game?
Well, tournaments really, there's not that much of a difference between the main difference is that, basically, if you look at the amount of chips you have in a cash game versus, like, in a tournament, the amount of chips you have in a tournament is more, like, it's more, like, in terms of, like, looking at terms of importance, the amount of chips, if you look at, like, if you graphed importance on the amount of chips you have, the graph for cash games ideally would be linear, but for tournaments, it would be... probably like a curved graph. It would curve like the side of an oval. It would go up pretty fast at first, and then it would like slope down with the more chips that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And that just affects. That's basically the only real difference in tournaments and poker. Yeah. And there are a couple implications of that, such that, like for example, you just don't want to lose too many chips, and maybe getting it in later is not as good, but other than that, it's pretty much the same thing.
Got another quick question for you. I'm not sure when you turn 21, but at your first opportunity, are you going to go to the WSOP and play the main event?
Yeah, I'll definitely be playing in the main, and just I'll probably try to play as many events as possible.
Yeah, well, I mean,
Annette did this year, and you know, got met at the door by reporters and followed around by reporters and hounded by reporters and the whole bit. You may get some of that, too.
Yeah, here's my advice for you, Dan. Don't let Bluff Magazine do a big cover story on you that they then blow up and put all over the Pavilion Room and the Amazon Room next summer because, you know, we just thought that they set the expectations way too high for Annette when she went out there this summer after her success at the WSOPE.
Yep. Yeah, you walked in the door, and there's a four-foot-tall poster of her staring you in the face.
Yeah.
You know, and the expectations, and first tournament for her, and, you know, now in Vegas, and, you know, all this other stuff. And she literally was hounded by reporters out there. It couldn't have gotten her head on straight. It just couldn't be a good situation at all.
Did you run into any of that when you were in London, considering that you started the Dur Challenge at the end of August, and you were in London just a couple of weeks ago? Did you run into a lot of the poker media taking special interest in you now?
Yeah, well, maybe I wasn't hounded by any means, but I did a few interviews and stuff like that.
That actually may be good for you then, may break it in a little bit.
Yeah.
All right, I got one last question for you. All righty, you're 20 years old, still going to college, enjoying life. You just won another $600,000 off of Dur, which is nice. What are you doing with it? Where are you spending it? How has it changed your life? Anything in particular? How many girlfriends do you have now?
Don't ask him that.
A secret. I won't go into that. let's see. Well, lately I haven't really been spending it that much, actually. I've just been mostly buying, like, all the little things that I want. If I want, like, if I want to go, well, one thing I've been doing is that I've been eating out, like, every day. Going to restaurants and stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I have, like, there's a certain renown that follows being Jungle Man, which is nice. That's certainly changed my life a bit. But as far as the money is concerned, it's changed it. I mean, I guess you could say actually dramatically, that I just buy anything I want. But I haven't been spending that much.
But you know what? You know what? I bet part of it is, and we hear your friends laughing in the background, but I think part of it probably for you is that the money is really just a way of keeping score. That, you know, when the numbers go up, that means that you're winning and that you're adding on to the legend of Jungle Man that you're kind of creating here very, very quickly. Isn't that part of it?
Yeah, you could definitely say that.
Yeah.
Right. Building on the renown, building on the legend of Jungle Man.
Is there any one player that you want to play that you haven't played yet?
Let's see. I can't really think of anyone. Well, the old school players, like old school Nosebleed players, like You're in Danger.
Okay.
I'm not sure if T-Rex would play me, but that guy, you know, those guys, maybe Gustav would probably be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool.
So you'll get to them when you'll get to them once you're done with Durr and Isildur, and you know, you just mow through the field, Dan. That'll be it.
Yeah.
Well, I know you've got big support from guys like Phil Galfond, who calls you one of the top five heads-up No Limit Hold'em players in the world, and Justin Bonomo and Ike Haxton and a bunch of others. You've gotten yourself an enormous amount of respect for a guy who's only really been on the scene for about 3 years now, and we wish you the best of luck with the rest of the Durr Challenge. You know, you've got a big announcement coming up soon that we can't talk about here, but we wish you luck with whatever that turns out to be. And we hope that we can talk to you later on, you know, after the Durr Challenge is done or later on as your success continues to build. We really appreciate you making the time to come on the show with us today.
Yeah. And I'll tell you one other thing, too. Not that you need it, to be honest, because you sound like you've got your act together pretty well. But if you have some questions, something like that, anything I can answer, feel free to give me a call. I don't have any great words of wisdom, but I can. But at least I've been there before, so.
Yeah, about the life management part of being a poker pro, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. Good stuff. Dan, thanks so much for your time today.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
That's right, Daniel Cates, Jungleman 12 online. You can keep up with him through the Durr Challenge and all the rest. Pretty remarkable at age 20 to be playing for those kind of stakes.
Yes.
And to, you know, obviously he's got a pretty good strategic head on his shoulders.
Oh, it sounds like it, absolutely.
Next week we're going to talk with Brandon Stephen, the guy who went out on the bubble for this year's November 9. You've seen him on the coverage the last couple of weeks on ESPN. He will join us next week here on The Final Table, which is brought to you by PokerStars.net and the Poker Players Alliance. From Table 2 in the Harris St. Louis Poker Room, I'm Paul Harris, along with Team PokerStars Pro Dennis Phillips. Thanks for listening to The Final Table on thechipleader.com and Five Night of the Fan KFNS and KFNS.com.